Common ancestors. So any two people in this room, if you go back far enough in time, you will find an organism who is an ancestor of each. And that's not just human beings who are related to each other. Take human beings and monkeys. You've got to go back still further to find that common ancestor. And the bold, amazing claim of contemporary evolutionary biology is that everything that's alive today, plants and animals and bacteria, go back far enough and you'll find what Darwin called the original progenitor. Darwin was a little uncertain, as well he should have been, because he didn't have the kind of evidence that biologists have now. He was a little uncertain when you trace back current organisms to their common ancestors and trace those common ancestors back even further. Do you come to one original progenitor, or are there a couple? I mean, he speculated, well, maybe all of the animals that are alive and now go back to a first original animal ancestor, and all the plants go back to a first plant, but maybe the plants and the animals are the results of separate independent startups. And he thought about this. He tentatively thought, well, maybe he wanted to go with the idea that there's a single common ancestor uniting all living things. But at the end of the book, in the beautiful last paragraph of The Origin, he says that life was first breathed into beings on this planet in one or a few original progenitors. So he sort of waffled on the question about whether it traces back to one or a small number. Modern biology takes the stand that there was one. Evolutionary theory in its standard form now regards natural selection as a very important part of the explanation of why plants and animals and other organisms now are different from each other. They live in different environments, and natural selection has caused them to be adapted to those different environments. That's not the only explanation of variation that evolutionary theory offers us, but it's a very important part of it. And finally, there's this idea I mentioned before, the idea that mutations are unguided. So that's what I mean by evolutionary theory. That's, I'd say, is the sort of standard everyday picture that biologists have. That's what they mean by this theory. Well, let's think about the question of how this theory is related to the question of whether God exists. Well, one option that's out there among several to consider is the view that I'm going to call atheistic evolutionism. It's the idea that evolutionary theory is true and there is no God. And highly visible now are some critics of religion, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett being two prominent examples of atheists who think that evolutionary theory and atheism go hand in hand. And really, if you believe the theory of evolution, you ought to be an atheist. The natural, perhaps inevitable view to take about whether God exists, if you believe evolutionary theory, you ought to be an atheist. Another familiar idea that's out there, highly visible in our culture, is creationism, which rejects the theory of evolution and holds that God exists. It might look like these two views are miles apart from each other, and indeed they are. The one accepts evolutionary theory, the other rejects it. The one accepts the existence of God, and the other rejects it. But there's something interesting that they have in common. They have in common the idea that there's a conflict between the theory of evolution on the one hand and the thesis that God exists on the other. If there's a conflict, you can't have them both, right? You got to take the one but not the other, or the other but not the one. And those are the two options you get out of thinking about there being this fundamental conflict. Those are the two choices. Well, are they really inconsistent with each other? The idea that there's a conflict between evolutionary theory and the existence of God, it's not just a couple people have thought. This is a powerful, influential idea that there's this fundamental conflict. But one of the main take-home messages I want to develop tonight is that there, in fact, is no conflict. That the idea that you've got to choose the one but not the other, or the other but not the one, is based on a kind of limited view of what the options are. It's true that the conflict thesis, that they're at odds with each other, it has been suggested to many people by looking at what evolutionary theory says. But here I want to quote the great biologist Jacques Monod, who says in his book, which is not about evolution and creationism, about something else, but I love this little phrase from his book. He says that any confusion between the ideas suggested by science and science itself must be carefully avoided. So this is, I'm applying Minot's dictum to this problem. Atheism is suggested to many people when they look at what they think the theory of evolution says, but I want to draw a sharp distinction between what the theory actually says and ideas that occur to people when they think they're thinking about it, when they are thinking about the theory. And so there's a third option that I want to present as a logically consistent picture. I call it theistic evolutionism, and it holds both that evolutionary theory is true and that God exists. And my point tonight is not to tell you that theistic evolutionism is true. I just want you to see that it's an option that has to be considered, and it is a blinkered view of this problem to think that the only options are the first two. So this is I'm trying to give a kind of roadmap of the things one might want to think about in sifting through these questions oneself, without really saying anything about which of these is the most plausible or defensible view. I want to talk about what you need to think about to get to some sort of answer to that question. Well, here, it's important to understand the difference between theistic evolutionism and creationism. They both have God in the picture. They're both views about how God is related to the natural world. Theistic evolutionism is basically the idea that the evolutionary process is God's way of making organism. God starts the evolutionary process and allows that to produce the daffodils and human beings and bacteria that we observe. Especially, including, you know, most vividly, the complex adaptive features that organisms have. Creationism also has God in the picture, but the thing to notice here is that slash through the arrow. That's the key difference here, because according to creationism, the evolutionary process is fundamentally incapable of producing the complex features that we observe in nature. And so what's got to happen for those to exist is for God to intervene directly in nature. So you might think that as soon as you bring God into the picture, you've got to be a creationist. Well, that would be true if the only theistic option were creationism, but here's a theistic option too. So the fact that God is part of your picture of the world doesn't force you to be a creationist. That's just one option. So here's some similarities and differences just to try to get these three options before the mind. They're united by different things, separated by different things. So notice, of course, that there are two of these views believe in God. One of them is an atheistic view. And two of them accept evolutionary theory, and the third one does not. And there's a third point that I made earlier, which I don't have a slide for now, which is that the first two of them, atheistic evolutionism and creationism, hold that there's a conflict between evolutionary theory on the one hand and the existence of God on the other. And that's a commonality that unites them and sets them apart from theistic evolutionism. So there are two, and now what about this idea of theistic evolutionism, that there's a way of reconciling or rendering compatible evolutionary theory and the existence of God? One way to make that picture consistent is a view that in the 18th century was called deism. It's basically the idea that God starts off the universe creating the laws of nature and then just stands back and never intervenes. And if that's your picture, it's easy to see how that kind of God is consistent with the theory of evolution. God starts the laws of he creates the laws of gravity, he creates the laws of evolution, and then it's hands off. I want to argue that there's a second kind of theism that's consistent with evolutionary theory, in which the God you're talking about is an interventionist God, a God who reaches into the natural world, into human history at times, and actually changes what's going on there. And you might think, wait a minute, I can see how the deistic picture can be reconciled with evolutionary theory, but this idea of an interventionist God, and of course that's an example of that view of God is Christianity. I mean, God is reaching into human history, according to Christianity, at certain key points. So I wanted to claim that not only is deism a consistent view, I wanted to claim that theistic evolutionism is consistent even when the God that's being considered is this interventionist God. And that might seem weird. Maybe it seems like you can't have science if you have that. That's one of the things I want to argue. Okay, what are Darwin's views about this? That was the sort of, what I just talked about was the kind of the part that I was promising to give you a little logical clarification of the options and how they're related to each other. And I want to talk about Darwin's views about theistic evolution and the difference it has with creationism. I want to talk about why he thought special creation was a crummy scientific theory, what his views were about whether there is a God, and finally what he thought about Christianity. So now for a little history. Philosophers love it when people outside of philosophy talk about philosophy. We all feel so ignored, you know. So it's great when you open up The Origin of Species to see Darwin talk first about two philosophers. The first thing that's in the book are these quotations from William Huell, who was a contemporary of Darwin's, great philosopher of science, and another philosopher, Francis Bacon, who lived 200 years earlier. And I want to talk about this quotation. This is the first thing after the title of The Origin of Species, and he's quoting Huell. Huell, by the way, never accepted Darwin's theory of evolution, and Darwin was, I think, pretty sure that Huell was not going to buy this theory, but he saw in Huell's philosophical work something that he thought could help him. So this is what he quotes Huell as saying, and I want to try to figure out what this thought is that he's giving his approval to from Huell. But with regard to the material world, we can at least go so far as this. We can perceive that events are brought about not by insulated interpositions of divine power exerted in each particular case, but by the establishment of general laws. What does that mean? I think Huell is talking about two different pictures about how God is related to nature, and Darwin is agreeing with Huell about which of these pictures is better. I call the pictures D and U because D is a disunified picture of how God is related to what we observe, whereas U is a unified picture, so I want to try to communicate what I mean by disunified and unified. So you've made a whole bunch of observations. Let's call them observation one, observation two, down to some large number of observations. And one way to think about how God is related to those things that you observe in nature is that in each case, that's the way it is because God says it should be that way. And this observation is the way it is because God made another decision. God decided that chameleons should change color, that human beings should not, that vertebrates should have a certain kind of eye, that bats should have a certain kind of wing, and in each case it's just a separate, independent decision. That's the idea of insulated interpositions of divine power exerted in each particular case. But what Huell is saying is a better picture of how God is related to nature is this unified idea where God creates general laws, and this small set of simple laws, like the law of gravity, Newton's laws of motion, and the laws of evolution that Darwin is trying to establish, this unified body of laws provides a unified explanation of why these observations are out there. So instead of explaining them as just this sort of one damn thing after another, you know, he did this and then he did that and he wanted this and he wanted that, there's this other picture in which God creates this general framework and everything we observe is a consequence of that single body of unified laws. The establishment of general laws is the model that Huell likes. It's the model that Darwin wants. And Darwin thinks of himself as trying to describe these general laws, the laws that govern change in living materials, and he's thinking of himself as doing for biology what Newton did 200 years earlier in physics, of providing a unified body of theory that explains both the orbits of planets around the sun and also the way cannonballs move on Earth, both movement up there and motion on the surface of the Earth are covered by the same equations in Newtonian physics. It's a unified theory. Darwin wanted to do that in biology, give a unified theory of why we see the diverse forms of life that we do. And he liked this. He didn't like that. Well, why? I mean, and this is what we're talking theology here, right? We're talking about Sure, God is going to be part of the picture, but which is the better model of how God is related to nature? This is what Darwin's talking about, what Hewell was talking about at the very beginning of The Origin. Why do Hewell and Darwin both like this and not think much of that picture of how God is related to nature? He says in The Origin, to my mind, it accords better with what we know of the laws impressed on matter by the Creator, that the production and extinction of the past and present inhabitants of the world should have been due to secondary causes like those determining the birth and death of the individual. Secondary causes from here to here, not direct primary causes from God to nature. Something is in between, namely the laws. Why did Darwin like that picture? Well, he says elsewhere in The Origin that on the ordinary view of the independent creation of each being, by which he means each organism, we can only say that so it is, that it has pleased the Creator to construct each animal and plant. So he's regarding this separate, this disunified model as a kind of empty explanation. The only thing you can say about what you observe is that, well, I guess God must have wanted it that way. Why do chameleons change color? Well, I guess God must have wanted them to do it. Why don't we? Well, God didn't want us to. Why do we have the eyes we have and octopus have slightly different kinds of eyes? Well, again, it's God's will. And Darwin thought that was a kind of empty explanation. It doesn't make any predictions about anything. It's just a kind of phrase that you can apply ex post facto to whatever you observe. That's not much of a theory. I think that was Darwin's view. Now let me change to another part of this historical little survey. Was Darwin a theist? Did he believe in God? Well, he wrote this wonderful brief autobiography at the end of his life, which he intended to be a personal document for his family. This was not, he didn't expect this would get published and read by lots of other people. And he's really speaking from the heart here, trying to get his, allow his children and his children's children to understand the kind of man he is and was. And he refers in the book to his religious views in a couple of occasions. And here's one passage that's kind of striking. He says, "The extreme difficulty, or rather impossibility, of conceiving this immense and wonderful universe, including man, as the result of blind chance or necessity, I feel compelled to look to a first cause having an intelligent mind in some degree analogous to that of man, and I deserve to be a theist." So when I was describing theistic evolutionism as an option, you look at this passage and you might think, well, Darwin was the first theistic evolutionist, at least in evolution in the sense of Darwinian evolution. That seems kind of a straightforward passage, but it gets complicated because a page later he describes himself as an agnostic. This is so confusing. I mean, when we talk about I think when we use words like theistic, theism, atheism, and agnosticism, I think what that means in our culture is that these three options are inconsistent with each other. So if you're a theist, you're not an agnostic, and if you're a theist, you're not an atheist. I think the conventional definition is theists believe that there is a God, atheists believe there is no God, and agnostics think we don't know that. So if you think you know that there is a God, you're not an agnostic. So how could Darwin have said that and then a page later say, I'm an agnostic? But notice, maybe this is not a contradiction. You know, he's a smart guy. Maybe he didn't contradict him in the space of a page. Because look at what he means by agnostic here. He means someone who has no assured and ever-present belief in the existence of a personal God or of a future existence with retribution and reward. So what he's talking about here is not just believing that there is a God, but to be a theist, defining it this way, you'd have to not only believe that there is a God, you'd have to believe that there is a personal God, and that means a God who hears our prayers and answers them sometimes. And you also would have to believe in an afterlife with retribution and reward. So maybe there is a consistency here. Maybe Darwin was describing himself exactly right when he said he's a theist, but he's a theist who doesn't believe in both a personal God and retribution and reward. But that's a kind of theism, too. But then Darwin says, and he says it more than once, that he actually feels like he's in a muddle about whether he should be a theist or an agnostic. he finds the subject bewildering. Well, Darwin, one of Darwin's sons, Francis Darwin, after Charles Darwin died, collected the life and letters, the remarks, and he refers to his father several times as describing himself as an agnostic. Here are two striking statements from Darwin. "The mystery of the beginning of all things is insoluble by us, and I, for one, must be content to remain an agnostic. And so whether the world began because God made it or not is something that he's saying, this is just too hard a problem for human beings to actually hope to answer." And the same thought of it's just being too hard a problem is present in this other quotation. "I think an agnostic would be the more correct description of my state of mind. The whole subject of God is beyond the scope of man's intellect." This is not atheism, right? It's not claiming to know that there is no God. It's saying it's a hard problem, insoluble perhaps. Well, what about Christianity? Here is a thing when you read it in the Origin, you never forget. This is written before Darwin died in around 1880. He says that Christianity is a damnable doctrine. Why did he say that? Because he understood Christianity to involve the view that non-believers are eternally damned to hell. And his father, his brother, and his grandfather were all not Christians. And he regarded this as a damnable thing. These are very strong words, and imagine how strong those words were back in the 19th century. And it's true, I think, although there's question about whether Darwin was a theist or an agnostic, and he describes himself as confused about this, and so it's really kind of hard to tell what he thinks about this. It's perfectly clear what he thinks about Christianity. He rejected it, and he walked away from it. It was, of course, the religion in which he grew up. And the thing that's pushing him over the edge here is this doctrine of eternal punishment for unbelievers. It's interesting to think about his wife, Emma Darwin, and why he and Emma had such different reactions to the doctrine of eternal punishment. Emma was Emma Wedgwood before she became Emma Wedgwood Darwin. You know, Wedgwood plates. Her father was Josiah Wedgwood, the potter who created all those beautiful pieces of china. And it was a family of serious Christianity. And Emma, when she thought, and her family thought about the doctrine of eternal damnation, they just thought it was an unchristian doctrine. And they're perfectly happy to be Christians. They just didn't buy that part of it. But what's so curious is that Darwin didn't see that as a live option for him. For him, that was so central that if eternal damnation for unbelievers is a damnable doctrine, then he was done with it. But there was another thing. It wasn't just thinking about what the religion said about said would happen after death to the people he loved and to him himself, perhaps. Darwin's favorite daughter died an excruciating death at age 10, and biographers of Darwin think that one was one of the critical personal events in his life that pushed him over the edge. And just seeing her suffer and die, he just lost his faith. It wasn't reasoning of philosophically, it was this emotional reaction. So if you had to ask why did Darwin cease to be a Christian, there's this thing, but I think the death of his daughter Annie was really very powerful in that respect. And that's because the thing that really got Darwin going, which really made him angry and think hard about how there could possibly be a God, is the problem of evil. He looked around at the world, and this is an experience we all have. You don't have to be a biologist or an evolutionist to think this thought. You look around and see how much suffering there is in our world, the suffering that human beings inflict on each other, the suffering that we experience because of natural disasters, and you wonder, how could a God allow this much suffering to exist? The puzzle is not, why is there some suffering versus none? The question is, why there's so much rather than 1 ounce less? That's the problem of evil. It's a problem you can think about and grapple with without being a biologist, of course, without thinking about evolution. And I think what was really driving Darwin's thinking about religion had zero, really, to do with his biological theory. I think he was thinking about what we all think about when we think about the problem of evil. There's a nice example. This is just one example of Darwin's thinking about this. Asa Gray was a botanist at Harvard who was the number one promoter of Darwin's theory of evolution in America. He helped prepare the first American edition of The Origin of Species for publication. He was Darwin's guy in North America. And they corresponded extensively both before The Origin of Species was published. By the way, next year is the 150th anniversary of its publication, 1859. They corresponded about that. And there was, although Gray liked the theory a lot, Gray wanted to put God into the theory in ways that Darwin resisted, and it's connected to what I'm going to talk about in a minute in connection with guided mutation. But one of the things they talked about is this parasitic wasp that's called Ichneumonidae. What this wasp does is it paralyzes a caterpillar and drags it into a little burrow and then lays its eggs inside of the caterpillar. Caterpillar can't move. The eggs then hatch and eat the caterpillar while it's still alive, though paralyzed. And the last thing these baby wasps do is eat the brain of the caterpillar. And Darwin regarded this as disgusting and just a kind of obvious demonstration of how much pain and suffering is just part of life. In the Origin, he says, it's easy to think, if you don't look too carefully, it's easy to think that nature is a place filled with joy and happiness. But when you start to look more carefully, you see that it's a war. It's a war, it's a struggle for existence in which great suffering, great death is an everyday thing. And so when Gray and Darwin corresponded about how God fits into the picture of Darwin's theory of evolution, Gray wanted to talk about how God is pushing the theory, pushing the process of evolution to produce certain outcomes. It's guided evolution. That was Gray's idea. Theory of evolution is fine, but you want to introduce God as a guiding factor. That was Gray's idea. And Darwin just wanted to leave God out of the theory. It's not that he was denying the existence of God. He just didn't want to have it part of his own theory. And why not? And I think why not was nothing biological, but rather being moved by the problem of evil and just being unable to understand how a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created that parasitic wasp. And that's just one example among tens of thousands. So what I think Darwin was being driven by, the death of Annie, was this one example of this bigger thing, which is the problem of evil. That's really what just stopped him in his tracks and made him have doubts about the existence of God, in spite of the fact that he thought that it's impossible to imagine our world just coming into existence by chance. So on the one hand, he's attracted to the idea that there's got to be a God because there had to be a first cause. And on the other hand, he looks around at the evil in our world and he has doubts. And that's the conflict. That's why he thinks of himself as being in a muddle. He was. Well, suppose we want to think about this problem, never mind Darwin, we want to think through the question about whether God exists and and also the sort of prior question of how you go about thinking about that. Well, here's a sort of menu of things to consider when you're trying to think your way through this hard question. Well, first of all, in philosophy, there are a number of sort of standard arguments for the existence of God. There's not just one argument, so that if you knock that over, there's nothing left. There are four or five main arguments. So one of them is the design argument. It's the idea that when you see complicated adaptive features in organisms like the vertebrate eye, you say to yourself, that's got to be explained by an intelligent designer. So that's called the design argument. A separate argument, and Darwin didn't have much patience for that. He regarded that, as I mentioned, as an empty explanation. That's not a serious explanation, he thought, of why the vertebrate eye has the structure it does. But there are other arguments for the existence of God. The first cause argument is not about the adaptive features of organisms. It's about the beginning of the whole universe. And the argument is the universe had to have a first cause. That's what God is. It's not about biology. It's about the whole cosmos. And Darwin found that argument intriguing, and he couldn't just walk away from that. So the design argument, he thought, that's not much of a theory, I can do better. But the first cause argument he was serious about, and there's some others, so I say et cetera, there are several arguments for the existence of God. So if you wanted to think through the question of whether God exists, you would want to consider these different arguments and think about whether any of them really work, whether any of them should convince us, if we're not already convinced already, that there is a God. Well, then there's the thing on the other side that also got to Darwin a lot, the problem of evil. That seems to be an argument against the existence of God. And you want to sort of weigh these against each other. You have, on the one hand, the arguments that God does exist, and then you have, on the other side, the argument from evil, which is can be thought of as an argument against the hypothesis that God exists. So how do you weigh these all against each other? You might think that if you believe the argument from design, you think that design in nature is evidence for the existence of God. Evil is evidence against. How do you put the pros and cons together to get some considered view? But then there's a prior question you'd need to think about, which is, why are we thinking about the question of whether there is a God as a question about evidence and reason? Why is it appropriate to judge whether God exists as if it were the kind of a claim like electrons exist or dinosaurs used to exist? Those questions seem clear. You want to look at the evidence, but maybe the idea that God exists is not that kind of question at all. It's a question that you shouldn't address by asking for the evidence. It's a matter of faith. So you, even before you look at these two things, you want to sort of know what the ground rules are, what kinds of considerations would be relevant, evidential considerations, or is it really a matter of faith? So that's a sort of outline of, if you wanted to sort of work through this problem, these are the kinds of things you'd want to consider. And I think that evolutionary theory has zero to tell you about any of them. It's just not in this line of work. These are philosophical questions. Evolutionary theory is not a philosophy. It's a bunch of testable claims about what happened in the history of life. So I don't think evolutionary theory tells you anything about whether God exists. It's just not on that subject. It's silent on the question of whether God exists. Just like theories in physics don't bring that in. But that's not the same thing as denying that there is a God. And here the important contrast is the contrast between Darwin, the man, and Darwinian theory, which is a bunch of statements about what happened in the history of life. And it's perfectly true, as I tried to explain, that Darwin did have religious doubts. I think they were mainly driven by thinking about something that has nothing to do with evolution. It's something that we all know about. It's the problem of evil. But don't think that because Darwin had religious doubts, that some it's intrinsic to his theory that it's in conflict with theism or with Christianity. That's a different matter. I don't really think there is a conflict down here, though there is. It's true that Darwin himself walked away from Christianity. That's a different point. All right, now the last part of the talk, I want to talk about this idea of guided mutations. And as I explained it earlier, standard evolutionary theory includes the idea that mutations are unguided. That seems to be a problem if you want to reconcile the existence of God with the theory of evolution, because theistic evolutionism seems committed to two ideas that are in conflict with each other. On the one hand, that God guides the evolutionary process, that's the theistic part, but it also seems to be committed to the idea that mutations are unguided. So how can this be consistent, to think that God is guiding the evolutionary process and also that mutations are unguided? It seems like we've got a contradictory, impossible kind of combination here. Well, I want to claim that there is no conflict here, but we've got to be careful about what the idea of guided mutation actually means. We've got to be careful about what biologists are actually saying. What do they mean when they say mutations are unguided? So clarify first what biologists mean when they claim that, talk about the kind of evidence they have for that a little bit, and then come back to relating the biological idea of unguided mutation with this theological question. Okay, so let's think about mutations as, in the same way I think we all think about roulette wheels. So one thing, I don't know if you're a gambler or not, but one thing I believe about roulette wheels is that roulette wheels don't land even or odd, because this would help me when I make a bet on even or odd. It's just had nothing to do with that. Where the roulette ball lands, of course, has its causes, but sort of what would help or hurt me is just not part of what makes the wheel behave as it does. And that's my model. I want to elaborate this analogy. That's my model for understanding what it means for saying that mutations are unguided. It means they have their causes, of course, just like the behavior of roulette wheels have their causes, but they don't land where they do because this would be good for organisms. That's what biologists mean by unguided mutation. Well, let's look at the analogy a little bit further and think about roulette. So that's your standard American roulette wheel. I had to look this up in Wikipedia because there are different kinds of roulette wheels. In America, this is unfortunate, don't you think? In America, we have 0 and 00. In Europe, they only have one of these. So actually, it's harder to win at roulette in America than it is in Europe. It seems so unfair, don't you think? Okay, so that's a roulette wheel. And we want to understand, suppose you walked into a casino and you wanted to do an experiment to find out whether or not roulette wheels land odd or even because of whether that outcome would help or hurt gamblers. You might have an opinion on this already, but if you didn't know, what would you do when you walked into a casino? What kind of experiment would give you information about that? Well, here's, I think, a nice, simple experiment. So you're going to play roulette a whole bunch of times, thousands and thousands of rounds. And sometimes the ball is going to land odd, and sometimes it'll land even. And you're going to make different bets at different times during this sequence of trials. Sometimes you're going to bet on odd, and so it'll be good for you if the ball landed odd. And sometimes you'll bet on even. And what we're going to do is you're going to make different bets in the course of this 2,000 trial experiment, and we're going to write down what percentage of the time the ball landed odd when you bet on odd. How often did the ball land even when you bet on odd? How often did the ball land odd when you bet on even, and so on? So these are the percentages. 27% of the time is here, 32% there, and so on. And the sad fact of the matter is that what you'll find when you do the experiment is that the percentage of time that the ball lands odd is the same regardless of whether you bet on odd or even. This is pretty much the same as that. And the ball, the frequency with which it lands even is the same regardless of whether you bet on odd or even. So it's this, it might not be exactly the same frequency. This might be 51% and this might be 52%, but it's so close. This is what you'll have if you do the experiment. It's so close that you just think that these are the same probabilities, and the roulette wheel is just not sensitive to you what you're betting on and what would be good for you. So that's, I think, what the outcome of the experiment would be, and it's the evidence that we could develop, if we needed evidence, for thinking that roulette wheels do not land odd or even because this or that outcome would be good for gamblers. It's data like this that make us think this. Okay, so that's the conclusion, I think, that we would draw from the experiment. And notice that this is what this is based on is looking at the average behavior of the roulette ball across thousands and thousands of spins of the roulette wheel. It's based on this kind of percentage data. It's not based on what happened on throw 37 in your experiment. It's based on the percentage of the different outcomes in thousands of trials. So when we say that roulette wheels land where they do without regard to what would be good for gamblers, we're talking about the average behavior of roulette balls. But I don't think that proves or even shows or has anything to say about the question about whether in the course of your 2,000 run experiment, God reached in once and had the roulette ball do what it did. Or maybe God was behind each outcome and that's why it happened. So when we say that roulette wheels are unguided in their behavior, we're making a claim about the average behavior, and I think that's just silent on whether this kind of process is going on. Now, my point here is not to say that you should believe that God is at work every time the roulette wheel is spun. I'm not claiming that that's true. I'm just saying that this question is not answered by the experiment we did, because all this experiment is telling us about is the average behavior, not what happens on each trial. Okay, now let's do this similar experiment for mutations. The model is the roulette wheel here. And so we're going to we have a fly that's blue, and we're going to consider two possible mutations it might experience. It might mutate from blue to red, or it might mutate from blue to green. Of course, it might not mutate at all. So think about these two possible changes that this fly might experience. And we're going to imagine that the fly could be in two different kinds of environments. It might be placed in a red environment, and it's better to be red if you're in a red environment. I'll tell you why in a second. And you also might put this fly into a green environment, and there it's better to be green than red. And the reason you're better off being red in a red environment and better off being green in a green environment is that I'm going to assume that these flies benefit from protective coloration. When they blend into their environment, they're better able to survive and reproduce than when they stand in color contrast with their environment. So we've got two kinds of mutations that might happen from blue to red, from blue to green, and two kinds of environments that we're going to put these flies in. And then we're going to do an experiment with thousands and thousands of trials. We're going to take a large number of blue flies, and we're going to distribute them into these two environments, the red environment and the blue environment, green environment, excuse me. And then we're going to see how often the fly mutates to red in each of those environments, and how often the fly mutates to green in each of those environments. So here's the experiment we're going to do. We're going to, if the fly is in a red environment, it's better off being red. If the fly is in a green environment, it's better off being green. And then we're going to watch in each of these environments, how often does it happen that the fly mutates to red, the fly mutates to green, and here we record the percentages of each of those kinds of events. And when biologists run experiments like this on mutation, what they find is what we find when we do that experiment on roulette wheels. The frequency with which the fly mutates to red doesn't depend on whether it's better to be red or green. It's about the same. Just like the frequency with which the roulette wheel drops even is the same regardless of whether you bet on even or you bet on odd. It's not sensitive to what's good for you. Mutation is like this too. It's just like a roulette wheel. So here's what I want to say about mutations, and I think I'm describing what the kinds of experiments that biologists do that's behind their claim that mutations are unguided. They don't occur because they benefit or hurt organisms. And again, this is a conclusion that's based on the average behavior of flies undergoing mutation, or whatever the organism is. And it really doesn't say anything about what happens each time a fly mutates. That's a separate question. And it just doesn't address this question about whether God is involved in the mutation process. So here's my, so to speak, unified picture of roulette wheels and mutations. There's a sense in which they're both unguided, and if you want to add to that the idea that God causes everything that happens to happen, that's a consistent view, because that's not something that the biologist or the experimenter on roulette wheels is getting at when they look at average behavior. So here's here's the big conclusion of the kind of picture I've been trying to draw tonight. I think that theism is compatible with directed mutations and with undirected mutations. I think if you believe in God, you should say to the biologist, you tell me whether organisms have the ability to control how they mutate. I mean, I don't know. You do the experiments, you tell me what the evidence says. I mean, it would be great if each of us had the ability to regenerate lost limbs. Some organisms have that. Wouldn't it be great if we had it? Well, it would be, I guess, but that's not a reason to think that we have this adaptive ability. We don't, and you know, you want science to tell you what adaptive abilities organisms have. It would be great to be able to guide your mutations in beneficial ways, but that doesn't mean that any organisms have it, so you want to ask a biologist. And if it turns out that biology is right in claiming that mutations are undirected in the biological sense of that term, I think theists can live with that. Just like theists can live with the fact that we don't have the ability to regenerate lost limbs. So when evolutionary biologists say the mutation is unguided, again, they're talking about the average rates of different mutations, and it just doesn't say anything about whether God is involved in each or every or any individual mutation event. So here's the summary of the whole talk. So I don't think evolutionary theory rules out the existence of God. In fact, I think the theory is consistent with a God who intervenes in nature and not just with a God who creates nature and then sits back. That's the deistic version of theism. But I think Darwin was exactly right when he thought that God did it is not a scientific explanation. It's empty. And so believing in a God who creates nature and he sometimes intervenes in it is just not a substitute for doing science. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elliot. The floor is open for discussion. Speak out so we can hear you, and I remind you to repeat the question for the benefit of the TV audience.
Okay. Yes, all the way in the back.
It seems to me that it's almost unimportant whether or not those mutations themselves are guided or unguided for people who think about randomness and the first law of physics, thermodynamics of entropy. Some of us would think, oh, it's amazing that life could even possibly exist and create the order that it has on this planet. For the mutation that occurs and whether or not it's beneficial or not, well, the result is in the result, whether that mutation actually allowed or helped that organism to survive in that environment. So the idea of the organism itself, the mutations, and the environment all put together is the picture of evolution and whether things can go forward or not. And what do we mean maybe by forward is an interesting question when you talk about the hand of God. Well, the hand of God, which has created that instant in time where there is that evolution or that space, or that genetic mutation, or that whole environmental system that thing mutates into, could we say that is the hand of God? Or could we say that's just kind of the result of all of the laws and all of the actions that happen over millions and millions of years, and during which there is extreme suffering, 99.9% of the species are gone. They're not even here. We might not be here soon. So I guess my concern is really about perhaps an intrinsic direction of evolution, an intrinsic purpose of evolution, to continue to create order and preserve that order in this place, on this planet. And that the drive doesn't, may or may not even necessarily require a hand of God if you put all those natural laws together and say all these things can happen, along with millions of years of individual random actions of mutations, and say we can end up with a planet with an amazing human being on it that is aware of what's going on and can do things to help the preservation of life on that planet as the ultimate goal of the life on that planet, self-preservation. So maybe if you could talk a little bit about randomness and entropy and self-direction and self-intervention in the direction of flow of evolution and how that might relate to theories of God.
That's a big, big question. It's at several. I want to focus on what you asked initially, which is, or claimed initially, that it's really not that important whether mutations are guided or unguided in terms of God's being involved. We have this natural process unfolding in front of us, and we can just study that process as a natural process and just not worry about whether God is behind it, making sure it goes this way or that. I think from the point of view of science, that's right. That's what science is about. It's about natural processes, things that happen in nature. But if you're a theist, you might want to know how that story about nature that science is constructing is related to the belief you have in whether there is a supernatural being, a God, and whether these two can be harmonized with each other. And what I was claiming is, you might not, if you're not interested in the question of whether God exists, you know, that my point was not to convince you to get interested, but to convince you that if you are interested, then you shouldn't dismiss the possibility that the existence of God is actually consistent with what science is telling us about the evolutionary process. I mean, what is inconsistent is a certain kind of biblical literalism. Okay, a very special kind of biblical literalism. That's inconsistent with the theory of evolution and with lots of other scientific theories too. But biblical literalism is not the same thing as believing in God. And that's really what I was talking about.
And we can believe in God in many ways. To think of God as a image in the image of man, someone, some individual thing out there making decisions, would be one image. Another image would be the combined existence of all matter, all energy, all physical laws, and the direction that it provides to the universe. And some people, like myself, believe that God is everything. And that may seem to some people like a cop-out, but I don't think so.
There's another way to look at the question that we're talking about here,
which is when we talk about God and whether God exists, what does that mean? What does that three-letter word actually mean? And I was tonight thinking about God as, if there is a God, God is a person, an agent who does things, has a mind, performs actions. And that's what Darwin was grappling with when he thought about the first cause argument. He was thinking of God as an agent who made the universe and found that incredibly appealing as sort of indispensable as a way of thinking about nature. But the idea that God is not a person, that he's identical with the whole of nature, it's a Spinozistic idea, that's a very different conception. Yes?
I'm thinking of the Dover case, and I'm wondering, as a philosopher, your advice to the school board or the voters in a democratic society, the respect of the belief in creationism, the belief in evolution, being agnostic, being atheist, how do you balance all that in a public education?
The constitutional principle that the separation of church and state has been interpreted by courts in terms of the effect that a policy would have in terms of promoting religion. So when the Dover trial unfolded, what was at issue was a version of intelligent design theory, which is something that came on the scenes in the early 1990s, in which the word God was not mentioned. So it was simply the idea that the complicated adaptations that we see in nature were made by an intelligent designer, and we're not going to say whether that intelligent designer was a supernatural god or extraterrestrials or scientists from the future beaming back to the present living things. It's silent on those questions. And this was formulated by the creationist camp as a way of trying to pass that constitutional test. I mean, if you don't use the G word, what's the problem here? It's just a theory like other theories. It might be a good or a bad theory, but it's not on its face religious. And the reason they lost the trial is that the legal question was not, is the G word used? It wasn't. The question was, would having a policy of this sort promote religion? And Judge Jones did not have difficulty deciding that because there was the transcripts of the meetings of the school board in which they said that was their goal. So it was kind of easy. I mean, and it's part of the reason why the intelligent design movement, whose center is the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington, before the trial even happened, the Discovery Institute had withdrawn from this trial because I think they just saw this was not a winnable fight. I mean, because of this question about whether policies would have the effect or they're intended to promote religion, that's the criterion. So that's I think that's a good criterion, and so I don't think it really matters for the legal policy questions whether the G word is part of this theory or not. It's what would happen if we had For example, a rule that said that intelligent design was taught as an alternative theory in high school biology. Would the effect of that be to promote religion? So that's I take it, where the legal situation is now. I'm sure it's not over. You can never think that this trial is the last trial. So we'll see another sort of mutation in this conflict, and we'll see whether it's different. Yeah?
At one point in your talk, you said that scientific theories were simply a testable series of claims. But early on, you said that evolutionary theory holds that life evolved from non-life. This is not really a testable claim. So is it thus not a scientific claim, or is the problem that you're arising at simply a oversimplification of what scientific theory is?
We can pick you up on this side of this microphone, but on that side.
Here we go. I do think that scientific theories, to be scientific, have to be testable. I think that the idea that life evolved from non-life is testable. The idea, I mean, what is so striking when you look at the organisms alive today is that they have these similarities that can't be explained except by postulating that they derive from a common ancestor. And enough is known about the processes by which this life might evolve from non-life, I think, to say with some confidence that that gives us some evidence that there is a natural process involved here. So the thing that's true, I think it's behind what's behind your question, is there's tons that's not understood about how this process of life evolving from non-life actually worked. And this is an area in which there are lots of big questions. There's lots that's not understood about it. But I don't think it's true that the whole proposition is kind of intrinsically, scientifically intractable. It can be broken down to pieces, and you can test different theories about how life may or may not have evolved. So I think it's part of science, but it's not, the story about this part of evolutionary theory is not by any means over and fully developed. A lot of the things here, like the idea of common ancestry, I think is sort of abundantly well documented. And it's true that not every detail is understood, but we know tons about common ancestry. The first thing here is the least understood, but I don't think it's a sort of inherently unscientific question to try to test theories about the way life might have evolved from non-living things. All the way in the back.
I was puzzled on slide 51. You said, so is atheism, and indicating that it would be compatible with directed mutations. And I'm
okay.
Just trying to imagine what that would be like.
Now, I'm talking here about the biologist's sense of directed and undirected mutation here. So suppose we discovered that some organisms, maybe not all of them, but some organisms have the remarkable ability to control what mutations occur. And they can control it so that the beneficial mutations are the ones that have the higher probability and the deleterious ones have lower probability. So it would turn out that the mutation process has this adaptive feature. If you're a biologist, you would immediately want to understand how that evolved, how natural selection might have produced this machinery that allows this to happen. And if you were an atheistic biologist, you would just regard this as yet another surprising adaptation. Just like, you know, when we look around at big mammals like us, we don't have the ability to regenerate lost limbs, but when we look at other organisms, they do. And it's not like an atheist should say, oh, I guess I can't be an atheist anymore. I mean, it's just a surprising adaptation that maybe you don't expect organisms to have, then you discover that they do. And that's what directed mutation would be like if we actually found it. It would be the sort of thing that biologists would take on as a problem, to understand how this kind of machinery could have evolved. So that's why I think atheists could have it. I mean, either way, it just doesn't touch what they think. And it doesn't touch what theists think either, I think. It's a biological question. Yeah?
Yeah, I really liked the roulette example that you gave. Except what I was thinking is, if causality can be analyzed at an aggregate average level, but not so much at the individual event level, Are you saying that evolutionary explanation only can handle causality at aggregate levels, but that individual events can't be explained by evolutionary theory?
I don't say it can't, but
what we know now about mutation is this kind of aggregate phenomenon. I mean, we know more than that, but there's room for, if you want to add divine intervention here or there, I don't see that biology is ruling that out. It's not saying that can't be so. It's also not saying it must be so. It's just open to the idea. I mean, the kind of broader, bigger picture that I have in mind here is that evolutionary biology is understanding the causes of events, but there's no reason to think that the causes that are on the list are complete. I mean, we document these, and we don't have any further evidence for other ones, or else they'd be on the list too. But do we have a proof that this list is complete? Well, maybe there are some causes that we're not measuring. Hidden variables is what they're called in physics. And evolutionary biology, it just doesn't say anything about whether such hidden variables exist, and therefore it doesn't say anything about whether supernatural hidden variables exist either. That's why it's just open. To add or not add that thing as you please, I think. Science is open about that. Yes?
I'm sorry, but I have to be really critical of a good 5/6 of everything you said. It seems to me that the only logical thing that a philosopher, a scientist, and anybody applying intelligent thinking to any such problems will come to the conclusion that the questions that science answers are all about how. Whereas the questions that religion answers are all about why. There's no overlap there. And you keep confusing the two issues. Can you comment about that?
I can comment. So I'll
try to repeat the question, which I should have been doing consistently. So the suggestion is that science is not in the business of understanding why things happen. That the why question is something that religion is addressing. Science, on the other hand, is really about understanding how things happen. And so the two subjects don't even intersect with each other. They're just about their answer approaches to different questions. I don't agree with 100%, not just 5/6. Let me try to say why. Okay, let me just start with the word why. I think the word why did this happen is a kind of ambiguous question. Sometimes when we ask why did it happen, we ask what's the meaning or the importance or the significance for us of the event. And I agree that if that's what why questions always mean, that I don't think science is really about that. But the reason I don't want to agree with your division of why and how here is that why questions are often just ways of asking for the causes of things. Why is there a full moon tonight is answered by astronomy. Why mutations occur is answered by the fact that you have radiation acting on these organs. So I think of why questions as very often, probably most of the time, just requests for a causal explanation. I think that's really what science is doing. There's a ton of, I mean, understanding the causes of evolution, that's what evolutionary theory is about. So maybe that's not central to the point you're making, I mean, but that is what I think about why, so I don't see why and how as sort of, science does both of those things. Let me rephrase now the thing that's behind here. So this is, I think, the kind of view you're describing is very similar to a view that the biologist Stephen Jay Gould put forward when he talked about there being two magisteria, two worlds, that science is about one of them and religion is about the other. Science is about why nature, and I'm using why in my sense, not in the sense you're describing, that what causes nature to change in the way it does, whereas religion is about the world of values, why things are good or bad, important, wrong, things like that, meaningful or meaningless. And his view, I think, which is your view, is that these are just on different subjects. Well, I mean, some of us do think about religion in just that way, but many people who are religious emphatically disagree. Of course, they believe that religion does address questions of value and ethics, But they also believe that religion is in the business of advancing true historical descriptions of how God was related to human beings. I mean, Christianity is, I mean, taken kind of, sort of literally the story of the fall in the Garden of Eden, the original sin, Christ's death being a way of redeeming mankind. These are intended by many Christians, well, I'll say most Christians historically, as factual claims about what happened in human history. And I think the Gould picture that religion is only about right and wrong is sort of ignoring this part of religion. And it's there. I mean, it might not be part of your religion, but I don't think we can define religion as only about whether things are good and bad and right and wrong and meaning. They're also about human history. Religions often are about that. So that's why the conflict is there that has to be looked at. Whether it's actually a conflict is another matter. Yes?
I'm interested in the idea of first cause. And you say that Darwin was intrigued by the idea of first cause and God creating the universe and setting up all of creation coming from God. I'm curious why he may find that intriguing, but not the question of, on a more individual level, why does one version of life exist over another? So why does the chameleon change its color? So to me, they're very similar questions, just on a different scope. So I'm curious why he may have seen that distinction, and from a philosophical standpoint, is there really a distinction between those two questions?
I agree with what you're saying. So the question is, Darwin did not think you needed to bring God into biology to explain why organisms have adaptations, but he did not dismiss the first cause argument, which says the whole universe exists because God created it. So the question is, was Darwin being consistent when he sort of dismisses intelligent design as a non-starter? It doesn't explain anything. It's just an empty phrase. That was his view. But when it comes to the first cause, he found it impossible to deny that. He just found it compelling. I'm inclined to agree with you that these are really on a par, that if you think that intelligent design is not a substantive explanation of why organisms have their features, why is the existence of God a substantive explanation of why the universe exists? So I think your question is a very good one about maybe Darwin's being inconsistent here. Yes?
So your talk is interesting because it really points out how uncomfortable many people are with the concept of randomness in much of life. And so you mentioned hidden variables, which goes to a long history of physics of trying to understand the uncertainty in quantum mechanics. And a lot of people from Einstein onwards have put a lot of effort trying to look for explanations for apparently randomness in quantum events. And really, to date, nobody has ever been able to found anything other than just really intrinsic randomness. So my question is really whether, when you talk about this logical third way, of perhaps there's a hidden hand of controlling statistical events, whether you can conceive that it's possible that people might be able to do very careful experiments and also come to the conclusion that really there's nothing else but randomness going on in the evolutionary sense as well as the quantum sense.
So the question is, how should I rephrase it? We have the concept of randomness in quantum physics. The idea of a hidden variable, which I mentioned briefly, is part of that discourse. And since the quantum theory was developed in the 1920s, there were brilliant scientists who thought there had to be hidden variables, that it can't be pure randomness. Let's just use that phrase. Einstein was in that camp, and more recently there have been physicists who have tried to develop theories that basically show that quantum mechanics as a theory is incomplete. It describes some of what's going on causally, but there are these other things that the theory is not taking into account. And these attempts to go beyond quantum mechanics have failed so far. The question is, I get to the question part. I think the question is, will we ever be in a position of being able to prove that there's nothing beyond the randomness, that it's just hidden variables all the way, that there are no hidden variables? I mean, we have the attempt to develop hidden variable theories, or to show that there are hidden variables and these have failed to develop, could we ever get to find ourselves in a stronger position where we could somehow prove that hidden variables are impossible? And there's a tradition in quantum mechanics of trying to develop arguments of that kind, which always have assumptions in them, and so you can always question whether the assumptions that are behind these arguments are compelling. I don't know, and having stated the question, I don't know. I mean, maybe we will be able to take it to this further point where we can, as in physics, show that the explanations we have here exhaust all that's going on causally. I don't want to try to predict the future of physics here. This is a question that physicists pursue, worrying about whether their theory is causally complete, wondering whether it's possible to show that it actually is, that quantum mechanics is the end of the road. And so physicists investigate this as a kind of problem in their science. There is no comparable question in biology, I think. Biologists can list a bunch of causes, mutation, the genetic system, natural selection of evolution, and for all they know, there's a deeper micro story going on there that's just not part of the biology. So I think that biology and physics are actually in very different situations with respect to this.
If I could just follow up, I mean, it seems to me that in both domains, practicing physicists and biologists can get on very happily without needing any of these underlying causes. Even though that they, which seems to indicate that they're probably not there, right? And that certainly leads it's the attitude of many practicing physicists. So again, I'm just asking if there's an analogy with practicing biologists.
I didn't quite get that dimension of the question, so let me restate that. Biologists and physicists can develop their theories, test their hypotheses without bringing in, let me just say, supernatural hidden causes. And for many of them, that's a good reason for thinking that there are no such things. And there you have a way of thinking that is appealing to many scientists, which does lead to atheism. But I want to claim that there's another way of thinking about science where you don't have to have such strong commitments, and you just stop with the first part of your comment, which I am inclined to agree with, that you don't need to bring in supernatural agents to do science. But if you stop there, you're not in the position of being an atheist. You're in the position of just saying, that's not a scientific question. And should you go further? Well, you have to ask yourself whether scientists need to assume something, whether or not they do, is a guide to what actually is out there. And that's a hard philosophical question. But the more modest thing that you said, I certainly agree with. I don't think you need to bring the supernatural agents into the practice of biology or physics. But that's just to say that the science is neutral on that question. It's not committed. Yes?
There are many things what you said that I don't agree with. First of all, Darwin is a hero, he's a genius, so, but evolution was true long before Darwin was born, and it'll be true when it's forgotten. It traces to me. Might have been somebody else was going to discover it, called Smithers or Joneses, but the truth of that has absolutely nothing to do with what Darwin taught in the 19th century, whether it's a Christian or not. All of that's an historical interest, but really has little to do with it. Matters and issues. That's one point. Another point is,
can I just respond to that?
So the observation is what Darwin was like personally, whether he was an atheist or a Christian or whatever, is just not relevant to the theory he put forward. That's what's interesting. Who cares about this guy? If he hadn't discovered it, someone else would have. In fact, someone else did discover it. Alfred Russel Wallace discovered the theory when Darwin did. It was this amazing event of simultaneous independent discovery of the same theory. So there was more than one discoverer, not just Darwin. So I completely agree with that. And remember there was this slide, I don't know if I can find it, where I talk about separating questions about the man from the theory. Yeah. So yeah, I completely agree. And I think the reason I think what Darwin was like personally is interesting. And I think partly because what he was grappling with is what many of us grapple with when we think about the existence of God, the problem of evil, the first cause. These are things he was worrying about. But then I was trying to show that that concern is really nothing about the theory of evolution. So I agree with that point that you're making.
Second
Just go ahead.
Point, the, you always mentioned submission as a philosophical question, does God exist? But religions don't stand up Sunday after Sunday and say God exists. They say all kinds of very specific things about what he exists, what he does, what he did, and so on. And even though the question of whether God exists or not may not be a conflict with the question of science, individual claims of what God has done or is doing are very drastic disagreement with it. And so you make it too easy for religion to be on par with science when you just put it in the context of does God exist? That's a philosophical question. But get to the specifics. You know, did God, is God in the image of man or man in the image of God?
Okay, so the comment is, it's one thing to show that the theory of evolution is consistent with the brief statement God exists, but what about more detailed statements about God? For example, that God made the universe in 6 24-hour periods. And remember, I mentioned very briefly in the talk biblical literalism. There is a conflict between certain kinds of biblical literalism and tons of science, not just the theory of evolution. So I don't dispute that. But I don't want to. I wanted to separate that from this more modest question you're right about, which is not claims like that, but claims about the existence of God, certain key claims of Christianity, which is a bit more than just that God exists, and talk about how that's related to biology. So I certainly agree that there are kinds of religious statements, or specific religious statements, highly specific religious statements that are in conflict. So the idea that God, that life began 10,000 years ago because of divine intervention, that's inconsistent with evolutionary biology. Evolutionary biology tells us that life began more than 3 billion years ago. So just for starters. But you see, that particular view about young earth creationism, I mean, I don't equate that with religion. That's just one example of a religion. And yeah, that's inconsistent with theory of evolution.
I guess the last point I'd make is your story of the roulette wheel, guided versus unguided. Mutations, you use the word mutations over and over again, but true that mutations are not guided if they're random and so on, but the results of mutations in biology are that the organism changes, and also that the very change is propagated to the next generation, so that when one mutation leads to something that survives better and another one leads to something which is not so successful, and they pass those traits on to their progeny, then basically what seemed to be unguided or random at first becomes very non-guided and is very guided, because it's what leads to success in achieving the way that we understand evolution, not that it's just some random process that makes this and that.
Okay, the idea is that there's a disanalogy between the way in which roulette wheels are unguided in the way they behave and the way in which mutations are unguided. What I was saying about the similarity was that in both cases, it's not true that roulette wheels behave as they do, or that mutations occur because they would be good for somebody, good for the gambler, good for the organism. So that's the point that I was trying to establish. I agree with what you said about the process of evolution by natural selection, that it begins with random, unguided, in that sense, mutations. But then there's this non-random process, which is the process of natural selection. It's not random, but a directional process in which traits that help organisms to survive and reproduce are going to become more common in a population or a species, and traits that hurt an organism and make it less able to survive and reproduce are going to become less frequent. So there's this biasing part of the process of natural selection. It's not a coin toss which of these two traits is going to increase and which is going to disappear. The one that helps the organism to survive and reproduce is the one that evolved under natural selection, but that's separate from the question of how mutations occur. So the thing that's kind of hard to, for I think, for people who come upon this theory for the first time to understand is, so you have mutations being where novel characteristics first appear, and then those new characteristics become common or not because of a selection process. And the thing that's happening over here is random, and the thing that's happening over here is not random. So the theory has this combination of a random part and a non-random part. And often people think that the whole theory is just, you know, monkeys and typewriters. Well, it isn't. The mutation part is like that, but then there's this other stuff that has this biasing in it. So I agree with your observation.
I'd like to make an observation before we all thank Professor Sober and adjourn to the book signing just outside the room. This has been a very engaging conversation. Engaging because of you. Engaging because of you. And I can't tell you how pleased I am that this engaging conversation has been taking place in the chemistry building rather than in some other location. And I hope that my colleagues in chemistry and physics and in biology and in the arts will continue to think about what Professor Sober has for me succeeded in making me think some more about. So please join me in thanking Elliot for this excellent presentation. Thank you, Elliot.
Very enjoyable.
Very good. Thank you.